and welcome to Gascast. For this episode, we're getting psychological as we explore cognitive aspects of decision-making, non-anesthetic technical skills, and mental performance-enhancing drugs. We're also going to talk about bringing blood to trauma victims, as well as our usual discoveries, biology of bunkum, and question of the month. I'm Rick Thomas, and joining me are Rebecca Smith.
Hi.
Frank Schneider.
Hello, everyone.
And Mark Salmon.
Hello.
So this is actually attempt number two at trying to record this episode after a previous epic fail earlier this week. I suffered a Linux Pulse audio-related meltdown followed by Bex's laptop running out of battery. But the good news is Bex is now the proud owner of a brand new MacBook.
I am. I'm trying very hard.
So, fingers crossed, after a couple of episodes of skipping, we'll now be able to hear Rebecca's dulcet tones as a nice clean audio stream. So, Rebecca, apart from your new computer, what else have you discovered new this month?
My discovery of the month is a website called Open Anesthesia. It's a website that is approved by the International Anesthesia Research Society. And it's a website that's designed to look a little bit like Wikipedia. It's divided into a number of sections. There are some podcasts. There is some articles either on anesthetic topics or on critical care. There are some ways to earn continuing medical education points, although these are predominantly in the States. Now, I don't think that all of the topics are of that high quality, to be honest, but what I do really enjoy from the website is that they have a transesophageal echo of the month. And in this, there's a doctor that describes a clinical scenario, and she talks you through the echo that they've done intraoperatively. And it's just a good way, for me to familiarize myself with different views that you obtain doing esophageal echoes and the findings in different pathologies. I think echoes are, well, especially TOEs, are becoming more commonly used in anesthesia. And unless you actually get to do a cardiac job, you won't necessarily have the opportunity to see many. So this is a nice poor man's way to see more transesophageal echoes and improve your skills in this area.
That's great. So what's the URL for that?
It is openanesthesia.com, I think, isn't it, Frank? You know this website too.
It's openanesthesia.org, and it's anesthesia spelled the North American way, so A-N-E-S.
A-N-E-S. And they've got podcasts as well?
They do. Obviously not quite as high quality as ours, but they're there.
Well, naturally. So I'll go next. So for my discovery this month, I've been back to Twitter and discovered something called Gas Class. This is a really excellent medical education resource that is run by an anaesthetic department somewhere in the UK, or I'm not quite sure where. The idea is that they have a blog, which is at gasclass.wordpress.com, where at the beginning of every week they post a bit of information about a hypothetical anaesthetic case and then pose a question, the idea being that you then take to Twitter to make contributions in 140 characters or less using the hashtag GasClass, which, as we discussed before with Twitter Journal Club, that makes the discussion searchable. So having posed a question on the first day, on the Monday, you then see a load of people contributing and discussing the case using the hashtag GasClass, and then day by day they reveal more details through the blog as the case evolves. The topics are really well thought through and varied, covering anesthesia, ICU and pain, and a design with twists and turns that keep you thinking. It's a really great idea, and it's really good for anaesthetists. Many of us spend the day sitting in theatre, where you probably have access to your smartphone, but not to a laptop, and you haven't really got the time to read massive case summaries and post lengthy comments. But what you do have time to do is read a quick few sentences and then make your contribution through your iPhone or your Android device and during or in between cases. It's really fun. It's very friendly and certainly keeps your brain ticking over. I've now gotten into the habit of just checking it every day to see how things are progressing, having a quick scroll through the conversation that's going on, and I very often learn something new. As much like we found with the podcast, the internet's an amazing tool for making geography irrelevant, and GasClass gets contributions from all over the world, which makes for a more interesting discussion. So it's really great. Check it out using hashtag gasclass or gasclass.wordpress.com. I should probably mention that despite the similar names, gasclass has nothing to do with us. There are only so many permutations you can have with the prefix gas followed by something internet med-eddy based. But it's really good.
Comments, anyone?
I'll just throw that open to the floor there.
I think that does sound really good, although I fear I'm still not enough of a Twitter user.
I noticed you've opened an account though, Frank.
I opened an account a little while ago, but sadly the thing that put me off the most is I couldn't really get a username that that I was happy with or had anything to do with my name, because they've all been taken ages ago. And I haven't spent much time playing around with it.
Yeah, so you settled on Sexy Frank Schneider, which I think is reasonably appropriate.
If nothing, at least accurate.
Optimistic, some might say.
But I agree with you. I mean, I think there are some really interesting things coming out. I mean, I think Twitter Journal Club is a great idea. And this does sound like a very elegant way of following things, as you say, in theatre or when time's short.
I did Twitter Journal Clubs after we talked about it last time. I did go on, I think it was a couple of days after we finished the recording. And it was good fun, although it's very frenetic. The difference between gas class kind of takes place over a week, but also actually takes pace at a very different pace to Twitter Journal Club. You kind of sit there, have a think about it during the day and think, oh yeah, that's probably quite a good point. I'll see if anybody else has spoken about that. Take time to reply, whereas Twitter Journal Club basically all happens within an hour. Right. It's sort of, you get to that time on a Sunday evening, the Twitter Journal Club person goes, right, let's go, and then, you know, there is a first question, but then it's lots and lots of people talking very, very rapidly. I had made the mistake of doing it on the computer, but then having my phone on at the same time, which goes bong every time someone replies to something. And it was just madness and chaos for about an hour, and then also kind of dies down and stops. So very different things, but I think both really great. So moving around the table, Mark, what's new in your life this month?
So I've been looking at a new product, which I'm told is due to hit the market within the next couple of years, which should really change the way we can deal with our pre-hospital trauma patients. And that product is a lyophilized human plasma. So lyophilization, as I'm sure you all know, is a freeze-drying technology. And the manufacturers, Hemcon, who are developing this in conjunction with the US Army, believe that they can freeze-dry appropriately screened plasma, which can then be kept in its dried form for long periods of time and reconstituted with sterile water in less than 2 minutes, ready to administer to patients, and should have the same kind of clotting factor activity as it did on the day it was frozen. So that sounds like a very promising and simple product as compared with the kind of advance notice and 20 minutes thawing out and limited shelf life of thawed, fresh frozen plasma that we use at the moment.
It really does sound amazing, this product. I mean, we heard about this before when we tried to record a couple of days ago, and I was equally as amazed by it then. But I'm even more amazed you've actually, since the couple of days, you've learnt the word lyophilized.
Of course.
it's rolling off the tongue a lot easier this time, Mark.
Yeah. Which is good. So what does it mean, was what I was actually getting at.
It just means freeze-dried, and Wikipedia won't tell me any more than that.
Use it 3 times and own it. Have you seen sort of a picture, or by weight for sort of 250 mils, which I suppose is the standard volume of FFP, how much of this lyophilized FFP do you need in terms of weight?
I'm not sure, but it's not a great deal. It'll, I believe, be coming in kind of one unit preparations, and therefore should pack and weigh very little.
Be like a small brick, basically.
Yes, as far as I know. Although getting pictures of it is difficult. Most of what I've got is word of mouth through people in the industry.
See, I'm still interested how it stacks up against against the other products we've been using, like, and I have no sponsorships, but Berryplex and Nova 7 and that sort of stuff. and obviously which are have got very good evidence for their use, but have become or are very expensive, and whether the cost and efficacy or how they compare between lyophilized FFP, and whether that's, I mean, I don't know what the cost is going to be, and perhaps they also provide a greater range of factors, but it'd be interesting to see as the product becomes available. And from what you're saying, it sounds like it probably will be used in the military environment, certainly, and you know, perhaps your kind of pre-hospital work, and the information that comes out of that in terms of comparing to other products available, and whether the drug companies are going to get nervous about whether that's going to take up their market share.
Yeah, I mean, that data isn't available yet. So far, I've seen work about whether or not it's safe and how the clotting factors degrade over time after it's been reconstituted, but certainly I've not seen anything comparing it to individual factors. I think for trauma use, it's working on the basis that giving the whole lot of all of the goodies that are in plasma is the way forward, rather than, you know, you need several different bottles and concoctions if you were doing it all separately.
Plus, in trauma, you get your bit of volume resuscitation with your FFP that you don't necessarily with Nova 7 or Beriplex.
Yeah.
On a similar subject, but as an aside, I don't know if anybody can answer this, but it's something I've always wondered. When they tell you it's going to take 20 minutes to half an hour to defrost the FFP, why can't you microwave it?
Off the top of my head, I would have thought that all of the fragile proteins in there would be sensitive to becoming too warm. And microwaving
doesn't... It's not an even way of...
Yeah.
It's not an even way of heating it.
Well, my microwave has a defrost thing.
So you mean a defrost setting rather than...
Yeah.
There's a study in that, Rick.
Well, I'm sure there isn't. I'm sure somebody's... I'm sure there's an answer to the question, what there is, but I don't know what it is.
Well, has anyone ever worked somewhere where they microwave fluids to warm them?
Yes, and then we were told not to.
Yeah, so,
or,
I mean,
why?
The thought is out there.
Yeah. Why were you told not to microwave fluids?
I don't know. I don't think health and safety approve of it.
But why? It doesn't irradiate them and give them superpowers.
No, I think the concern was that, again, you don't, it's not even heating, or the heating is not evenly distributed, and you don't really know what the temperature is at the end of, you know, because obviously people haven't looked at it, and most places don't have a way of actually measuring the temperature before you infuse whatever you've microwaved, and the risk of sort of thermal injury. I mean, there are ways around that, though.
Rather than speculate ourselves, if you go to pathlabtalk.com, a forum for blood bank workers, this very discussion has been going on for quite some time, and it seems that some of them do use a microwave, but they have to be very intensively validated to make sure that they're not damaging or overheating. But most places say they use a water bath, but plasma in the microwave takes 5 to 7 minutes for 2 units.
Amazing. The internet, ladies and gentlemen. So that's pathlabtalk.com.
Yeah, I just...
Oh, there you go. So,
I Googled, well, why not microwave FFP? And that's tough.
That really is stunning, isn't it?
On the one I found, it says that you have certain parts of the bag become overheated and then white particles appear, and this is thought to be fibrinogen, which precipitates out at 56 degrees Celsius. And if you are going to use a microwave, your best one is one that keeps the bag moving to avoid uneven heat distribution. And apparently there's quite a lot of problems with the bags breaking along the fold lines.
Yeah, here we go. Right, the FFP sits in a bag holder that is on the wall of the device. While the product is thawing, it agitates clockwise and counterclockwise to eliminate the chance of a hot spot.
Continuing to move sideways, what else do they talk about on pathlabtalk.com?
Let's move up and see what the top forum...
We could have a whole other podcast just on
this. Oh, they've got what's in the hot topics thread? Specimen storage tracking, cooler temperature validation, CO reference ranges.
They probably do their own podcast.
I was a fan. Enough of a digression.
Yeah.
That, okay, well, we probably stop that there.
Yeah, get ourselves back on track. Frank, why don't you do that for us?
Well, my discovery of the month is along similar lines, actually. I don't know if anyone else has ever been troubled by the amount of time you have to wait for platelets if the blood bank don't happen to have them available. Well, and obviously, as you know, in the UK, certainly blood banks are centralized, so often you need to get them from across town. If you're somewhere like London, that can take quite a few hours. And because I've been working in cardiac over the last while, we reasonably frequently need to get platelets. Anyway, so what we've come up with, or I can't take credit for it at all, but where I'm working at the moment, one of the ODAs came up with quite a clever idea for platelets that arrive, because what happens is that we tend to pre-order them so that they often are available or arrive before you're actually ready to transfuse them, depending on how the surgery is going. And one of the ODAs designed an agitator, a homemade agitator, which is basically use the ventilator in the anesthetic room, connect a bag to the patient end of the ventilator, and just put the ventilator on and cycle it so that the bag intermittently inflates and deflates. You then put one of the, whichever spinal trays you use or trays you use for central line insertion, and we happen to have a sort of A4 sized blue plastic tray that comes with our central line kits. So you take that and you put it over the bag, and then tape the bag of platelets onto the tray. And that then, with the inflation and deflation of the bag, moves the platelets around intermittently and keeps them agitated until such a point that you're ready to transfuse them.
That is genius.
So I don't know if that all makes sense. It's much easier to explain when you're watching the ODA strapping it all together with bits of micropore.
Film it. And then
yeah, no, take a photo. Yeah, or no, take a photo or film, and we'll stick it in the podcast
we'll stick
notes.
It up. That's a great idea, actually, yeah.
That's brilliant. That's really clever. So, moving on to our news and article section, we've kind of accidentally managed to theme this episode, looking at anaesthetic non-technical skills and cognitive errors. And there was a paper in either, I think it was last month or maybe the month before, was BJA, which was a research article in the clinical practice section called Cognitive Errors Detected in Anesthesiology, a Literature Review and Pilot Study. So I think this is probably a good one to kick this topic off. As I said, we kind of independently came up with this. I decided to look at this article for two reasons. Number one, we've frequently talked about task fixation error on the podcast, particularly in light of the NAP4, but I don't think we've ever gone ahead and explained what it is, although it is fairly self-evident. And the other reason was that I was sent on a compulsory patient safety course by my school a week before last. I figured this would probably tie in nicely with that. So the background for this, for people who are not familiar with this particular branch of study, is that medical errors account for nearly 100,000 deaths per annum in the USA. And as trainees, we spend a lot of our working time trying to hone our skills to avoid technical error. However, most of our working lives will be spent at the consultant grade, and whilst there's good evidence to demonstrate that in many aspects of practice, consultants make less errors than trainees, as this is the grade where we spend most of our time practicing and facing the more difficult cases unsupervised, this is realistically where the bulk of our errors during our career will in fact be made. The article then goes on to point out that only a fraction of these errors are in fact technical, the majority being errors in thinking. These cognitive errors are due to faulty thought processes caused by our own psychology that we frequently don't recognise and are usually unaware of. As we frequently hear in anaesthetics, this has come straight from the aviation industry, where they've realised for many years that human factors are more often the cause of disaster than technical malfunction. However, injury due to or death of a single patient during a host of complex medical procedures is relatively low impact compared to a large-scale disaster like a plane going down. And as such, these types of cognitive errors often go unchallenged and unnoticed, which is why they're sometimes referred to as low visibility errors. The reason we make these errors is contrary to popular belief, humans are not logical. In fact, they're not remotely logical. This has been demonstrated by much of the current work on how we form memories and the fact that we're incredibly fallible, prone to subconscious suggestion, and masters of self-deception. These traits have been exploited for centuries for our own titillation and entertainment, most recently by the likes of people like Derren Brown. However, the reason our brains are hardwired to work in this way has evolved out of necessity for speed and survival. Our brains are hugely limited in processing power. You've probably all heard of the term 7 plus or minus 2, which is used to describe the maximum number of separate entities we can consider and compare at any one time. So to speed up decision making and increase our chance of survival, we use two procedural shortcuts when decision making or undertaking these cognitive processes. Number one is that we use heuristics. A computer is able to consider all the individual elements of a problem and rapidly form computations and arrive at an answer. We're not able to do that, but the world is fortunately a very repetitive place. So we rely on pattern recognition to inform us about our environment without the need to consciously analyze each individual piece of data, which mostly gives us an accurate enough image to make a correct decision. This is particularly relevant to medicine, where we regularly make diagnoses without a complete set of facts. Number two is that we make our decision based on emotional experience that best increases our odds of survival. So this is in spite of rational probability. The usually cited example is that of a rustling bush as you walk past, and your brain jumps to the conclusion that the causative agent must be a tiger, when a sparrow is in fact more likely, especially if you're walking around South London. However, by thinking tiger, your body's already started gearing up to make the correct action to avoid whatever subsequent mauling you may have from either the tiger or the sparrow. So coming back to the article gives an abbreviated list of the cognitive errors that have determined to be the most relevant to anesthesia. The list is quite long, and there is some overlap between them, but so I've sort of pruned it down to the ones that I either found most familiar to myself, or I thought was probably most relevant to the bulk of people out there. So I thought we'd go through them all with an example, and I think by doing that, you can hopefully have a look in your own practice and think, oh yeah, that is something that I would do. So at number one, we've got anchoring, which is the same phenomenon we've talked about when we've talked about task fixation, or otherwise known as tunnel vision. This is where you become focused on a task or the goal achieved by that task that all other information becomes filtered out. A classic example is becoming fixated when intubating a patient at the expense of worsening hypoxia, when what they need is, of course, oxygenation. The next one is called availability bias, and I like this one, and I think everyone has been guilty of it, especially as a trainee. This is where a diagnosis, circumstance, or outcome is overrepresented in your headspace due to being associated with a recent emotionally charged memory, which is usually a bad one. This overrepresentation leads to you making an unfounded association between a current situation and the remembered one. An example being attributing isolated bronchospasm to anaphylaxis and reaching for adrenaline, when in reality the patient has just been moved and the ET tube moved in the context of light anesthesia and has caused a bit of wheeze. Next we have premature closure. This is a case closed error in which a diagnosis is accepted prematurely and without sufficient evidence. You jump to the obvious conclusion and begin treatment, therefore closing your mind off to new information that may point to an alternative diagnosis. You may quickly, for instance, attribute hypotension in a septic ventilated patient to insufficient vasopressor or worsening of the underlying diagnosis, and then subconsciously ignore or fail to realize the importance of the rising airway pressures and rising CVP that would make you think, actually, this is a pneumothorax. Next is confirmation bias, which is something that's easy to remember and something we're all constantly looking for. Tangible proof that the real world matches up to our mental construct, which is inevitably a model that works to our own advantage. More simply put, we are searching out only the information that would confirm the situation we would like to be in, as opposed to the one we probably are in. And I'm sure everyone's either done this or witnessed this, and that's cycling the BP cuff for a fourth or fifth time because the previous goes have pointed to a situation which would require you to get up, think and act rather than to continue playing Angry Birds. Sunk costs is the next one, which we've certainly all witnessed, and I would say is probably one of the cognitive errors that you see more frequently in the consultant body than you do in trainees. Here, the perpetrator has far too much time invested in the diagnosis or the management to let it go and persists to the detriment of all concerned. An example is where you're struggling to insert a line or block, that is not strictly necessary but was on the plan, and you are now not prepared to abandon despite the increasing patient morbidity with each successive attempt. I would say to look out for this in cases where the ratio of anaesthetic room to operating theatre time seems hugely disproportionate. Omission bias. This is a good but a difficult one. It basically amounts to making a diagnosis, to not making a diagnosis, because the consequence of making that diagnosis requires an action that you feel uncomfortable performing. This is easier in a sort of scenario. So if you think about you've got an impending airway problem, but you can't quite go ahead and make that affirmation that you are in a can't intubate, can't ventilate situation with impending hypoxic arrest and no feasible exit strategy. And this is because you desperately don't want to admit this is the situation because you don't want to perform a cricothyroidotomy. This example also demonstrates that making a diagnosis can also relate to properly evaluating and realizing your situation, which is termed situational awareness, which you may have come across if you've been on one of these courses or watched the excellent TV show Archer. The next one is visceral bias, which is a Labour Ward favourite. This is where you falsely attribute aspects of a scenario to facets of personality of those people involved, which could be the patient or a colleague, because you have negative feelings towards them. So say you had an argument with your ODP in the morning and you therefore chose to ignore them for the rest of the day, including when they start warning you about a patient appearing light, and you sort of just hurry that away, when in fact the vaporizer is empty and despite you having switched it on, nothing's happening. And your visceral bias has led you to ignore this piece of evidence, which is the ODP, and therefore the error is made. And finally, my favorite, and this is only really because of the name, is called the zebra retreat. This is a situation where all the factors in a scenario point towards a rare diagnosis with a specific and often quite involved treatment, but you avoid making it because it is the one case where you have in fact calculated the odds correctly. Malignant hypothermia is the obvious example. In a situation where you have a rising carbon dioxide, a hyperthermic patient, and you're incorrectly attributing it to laparoscopic surgery or broken air conditioning, because MH is so rare that it is in fact an extremely unlikely diagnosis, even though it is the correct one. So it's a good paper. The literature review bit is mainly what it was there for. And they do actually go on to perform a pilot study of trainees in a simulator and then rate the frequency of the different types of defined errors they make, which I won't describe in detail. But the top three, unsurprisingly, were premature closure, which is the sort of case closed and then not looking for any other evidence. Confirmation bias, which is the cycling of the blood pressure cuff or only looking for information that you want to find out. And sunk costs. It was an interesting article and I think highlights the importance of both personal and team briefs after SUIs, a process which is not well formalised in my experience. The article goes on to discuss debiasing strategies, the first step of which has to be awareness of these problems and their existence. Anyway, I've had a lot of fun over the last week. I've not been in theatre, but I've had a lot of fun over the last week spotting the cognitive errors that I make every day, because it's not just there that you do it, it's your everyday life. I've certainly been very guilty of anchoring and sunk costs in the last few days trying to fix various bits of computer equipment to get the podcast going. So, yeah.
Where was that published, Rick?
It was in the BJA.
Cool.
Should we move on to talk about yours, Bex?
Yeah. So my news item is a study that came out of Seattle, and it was published in a February edition of the European Society of Regional Anesthesia. It's about a checklist that the ASRA, so the American Society of Regional Anesthesia, developed in 2010, and it's a checklist for local anesthetic toxicity. And it's similar to the AAGBI guideline that we're familiar with for the same scenario. Now, the checklist is really a step-by-step reminder of crucial therapeutic interventions, the drugs and dosages that are necessary for the effective management of local anesthetic toxicity. And what they did in their study was to try and assess whether or not using the checklist would improve trainee performance during a simulated episode of local anaesthetic toxicity. Now, the subjects that they used were anaesthetic residents in their first 3 years of anaesthesia, as well as clinical fellows that were working in regional anaesthesia and acute pain. And they distributed these trainees into two groups, making sure that each group had a similar level of experience. And about a month before they actually did the simulation, they distributed the checklist to the trainees in their department, but without fanfare, and they made sure that the checklist was available at every anaesthetic workstation. And then on the day of the simulation, they had a scenario which unfolded. And what it was a guy in his 70s who was having a hip arthroplasty and a femoral nerve block. And as you can imagine from the use of the checklist, he develops signs and symptoms of local anaesthetic toxicity and starts to deteriorate. And then the trainee involved in the simulation had to first make the diagnosis. And once they'd made the diagnosis, they were then allocated to being either in the group that was given the checklist or into the group that wasn't given the checklist. And then the scenario continued to unfold. And this poor man deteriorates. He ends up having a seizure. He then develops stable ventricular tachycardia, has to be given some intralipid, and then stabilizes and goes to critical care. And the way that the trainees were assessed was on two sets of tools, the first being their actual medical technical skills, and the second being these anaesthetic non-technical skills, which, Rick, you've just been talking about. And as you mentioned, they're basically a set of behavioral skills that involve four areas of task management, teamwork, situational awareness, and decision-making. And there were 28 questions on which the trainees were scored, the first seven being up until the time where they were either given or not given the checklist, and the next 21 questions were sort of were after this stage, and that was the primary outcome of the study, was how these trainees did with or without the use of the checklist. And the secondary outcome was the effect of the checklist on trainees' anaesthetic non-technical skills. At first reading, to be honest, I thought the study was a bit pointless. I don't think it was that surprising that trainees that were given the checklist outperformed the others. But I suppose that is actually quite an important message in itself, that if you have something rare like local anaesthetic toxicity, it's important that we do incorporate the use of checklists into our practice, because they seem to have superior medical management, which you can assume will result in superior outcome. But the secondary outcome of the study was what interested me, is that actually if you compared the trainees that used the checklist with those that didn't get given the checklist, the anaesthetic non-technical skills weren't actually any different, although there were some small but non-significant differences between junior trainees and senior trainees. Then they looked at the subgroups, and of the trainees that were given the checklist, they sort of fell into two camps. There was one group of people that just used the checklist a bit, looked at it sort of 25% of the time, but didn't use it all that much, and their anaesthetic non-technical skills didn't actually improve at all. But then of trainees that followed it quite rigidly, that used it much more and followed in a real step-by-step manner, their anaesthetic non-technical skills were vastly superior. And I suppose that is that in a rare situation, which is very stressful, if you're not having to rely so much on your memory, you can then, sort of your brain can be freed up to consider other management aspects like task delegation. So there was a couple of things that they didn't really cover in that much detail, which I was wondering, certainly we could maybe get Mark's input on it, is that one of the things I was interested in is that in the trainees that didn't get given the checklist, none of them actually requested it. So Mark, why do you think that they didn't ask for it? I mean, they've been given this checklist a month before, and then yet they didn't ask for it. And they, I was wondering, because you use checklists on a day-to-day basis, and it's not something I've ever done, what you thought that was about.
Well, I think this brings in lots of the error types that Rick discussed in relation to the paper he read. And as you say, I use checklists all the time in this job, and we use them for every case so that you don't have to decide that this case is different and I need a checklist. You just use it all the time, and therefore most of the time things go well and the checklist was a bonus, but if things are starting to go wrong, then you're trained with it. I think a lot of times calling for a checklist kind of announces to everybody that this is an incident rather than just something that I can deal with on my own. I think there's a bit of ego in there.
Part of on the simulations I was doing on this study day were about someone declaring there's an emergency. And I think that's a very relevant point you make, is that as soon as you get out a checklist and say, right, everybody, this is the situation, you're situationally aware, you've accepted this is where you're in, everyone stop what they're doing, and we run through this list. It is a good way of declaring an emergency, and a non-flappy way of doing it, rather than just sort of having a panic and going, oh my God, we're in an emergency. It's a good solid way to do it, and I think that is a good... It is,
but people seem, I think, reluctant to draw attention to themselves or the case like that. I mean, who hasn't been in theatre in labour ward and have an obstetrician insist that the blood loss was 2,490 mils because they don't want to cross the trigger that makes it into an incident, that makes it a code red or a major obstetric hemorrhage or whatever.
Precisely, and the point of calling something an incident is in fact to trigger loads of pathways so you're better able to manage these sort of things. You should have less of a threshold for saying, hey, this is an obstetric hemorrhage or something, shouldn't you?
Yeah, it's always been highlighted when you go to exam prep courses and practicing for OSCEs, you know, you always have to declare your emergency and call for help. So despite it being hammered into people from early on in the training, there still seems to be this resistance to do so.
Yes.
Bex, another thing that I found...
Yes.
Well, one of the things you found curious, which I might be able to explain in that article, was that there was this non-statistical but trend towards... trainees who were using the checklist, who were given the checklist and then used it, as opposed to those who didn't, about having better non-anesthetic technical skills.
Yeah.
You could say that this was in fact, because it wasn't a crossover study, because it would have been impossible to do, you could just say that those trainees who were intelligent enough to be given the correct answers to the scenario they were apparently it wasn't enough to be given the correct answers. You then had to realize they were the correct answers and use them, rather than kind of half ignore them. Have better non-anesthetic technical skills as a baseline.
That is a good point. Yeah, and did you notice that in that group it was only men?
Which is, I think, is probably a map reading phenomenon or asking for directions, isn't it? It's just an extension of that.
True.
So, concluding our ANTS, which is the acronym for anesthetic non-technical skills, I learned the other day. Although I didn't know local anesthetic toxicity had its own acronym.
Yeah, which is severe local last.
Which is a bit of an unfortunate one.
Yeah. we've had a last event. So, Frank, you have been looking at surgical non-technical skills from a slightly different perspective.
I have. Well, although I think, as you say, this is a trial run by surgeons, but I do think it probably translates to people working on a shift pattern. But obviously they looked at medical professionals. And I was just reading from Bex's article. It says here, a man's ability to retrieve information from memory is not only limited, but also made worse by stress, fatigue, or complexity. And that sort of leads us on to this article quite nicely. Now, I don't know if everyone familiar with modafinil or heard about it, or
we've mentioned it before on this. I think as a it's a drug that's also meant to enhance your cognitive powers, and I think students have been taking it, haven't they, to try and while they're studying for exams.
Yeah, that's right. So it's essentially a type of stimulant. It's called an analeptic drug. It's been used and is licensed for use in fact, for shift work sleep disorder, which I didn't know existed, but narcolepsy, which kind of makes sense. And it's, as you say, it's been used sort of off license and possibly, you could argue inappropriately by students across the states for purposes of studying for exams and staying awake for it. In any case, this is quite a neat randomized controlled trial, reasonably small numbers, about 40, that was run in London by the looks of it and the attachment of Aradazi's name to it, and it was done at Imperial. And they looked at the title of the article is Pharmacological Enhancement on Cognitive and Clinical Psychomotor Performance of Sleep-Deprived Doctors. And what they did was conduct a parallel double-blind randomized and placebo-controlled study, according to them, where they looked at, they were looking for 40, they had 39 male resident doctors. They avoided females because of the possibility of pregnancy, and essentially had two groups, one of whom were given modafinil, the other ones got placebo, and they were asked to stay awake for overnight, and then had a battery of tests they were subjected to, which are all pretty standardized assessment tools for cognition. Psychomotor skills were tested on a surgical virtual reality trainer. And really, they just looked at the effects of sleep deprivation on the performance. And I won't go through all the details of the study, but what was interesting, and I suppose just because I've been doing lots of nights and really hating it, is that that it does seem that doctors who are fatigued may benefit from drugs like modafinil that they enhance the ability to process information, flexible thinking, and decision making, especially under sort of time pressure situations. And the other interesting thing was that it actually didn't improve their psychomotor skills at all. So it really was just a decision making and the cognitive aspect of the performance. And I'm just wondering whether, you know, it's obviously a difficult area to study. And I can't really see our NHS trusts starting to hand out modafinil at 2 o'clock in the morning to improve the doctor's performance until the morning shift arrives. But it's just an area which will be interesting to keep an eye on.
Do you remember there was a study, I think we discussed it on one of the podcasts that we didn't release, but it came out of Mount Sinai Hospital, and it was on about labor epidurals and doctors that did them when they'd had plenty of sleep and then in a sleep-deprived state after no caffeine, and they looked at the psychomotor skills and whether people had, you know, increased unnecessary movements or increased complication rates, and the outcome of the study was actually that they were just exactly the same, and the only noticeable difference was the mood of the anaesthetist the epidural end.
Exactly what the paper said, and I can't remember whether or not we did cover it. And this had the same identical findings, which I thought was really, really interesting. But following on from what you were saying, the most significant findings in this paper were the self-reported, you know, kind of subjective thing about how awake they felt. That's where the biggest difference was. There was no difference in the psychomotor. There was a vague difference in the sort of cognitive tasks, but the biggest difference was just how they subjectively felt.
Yeah.
Which is the same as the mood of the anaesthetist.
Yeah.
But the in the second,
bring on the drugs.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes me feel better.
See, I think this is all really interesting, but as Frank mentioned, I cannot see a situation whereby we would ever be allowed, let alone encouraged, to use these kind of things to keep us going, because performance-enhancing drugs or stimulant drugs just have such a bad name with, you know, athletes and truck drivers and whatever. I can't see it ever happening.
Or how the Daily Mail would cover it. I mean,
well, that's
it would
what
just
I mean,
go
yeah.
to town.
That's what I mean. Even if the medics in charge could see the sense in it, getting it past the public, I think, would be an uphill struggle.
I on the bottom of the thing, when I read it, I've written in big letters, "Where is this going?" For exactly that point. It's interesting from an academic perspective. You know, here's some wild and crazy stuff, and this is what we found, which I think is not very much. In the second paragraph, they have this sentence that says, "Oh, it says that flexible thinking and decision making under time pressure, but was not effective in improving clinical psychomotor performance." But there was no. I mean, how often do we have to make really snap decisions when we're at work after night? You know, things where, because the sort of differences they're detecting here were statistically significant with the battery of tests they were using, but would they be clinically significant in the decision-making process we have to make as doctors?
You're right. I mean, I think it is difficult to. And if you look at the other studies they reference, I mean, all these studies, for the reasons Mark highlights as well, have been done in a simulated setting or a non-clinical setting. The military or aviation studies have all been done in simulators. So it's, you know, it is a whole argument as to whether that translates into clinical scenarios. But I do think that, I mean, there are areas where, you know, if you're faced with a can't intubate, can't ventilate scenario where you do need to make decisions quickly as to what's, you know, what's best to try next, or, yeah, even an arrest intraoperatively or something like that. I mean, I think there are areas where if you are, I mean, and I suppose we're not, most of us aren't particularly fatigued because hardly anyone does more than 12-hour shift these days, but after doing a series of nights, and the whole purpose of modafinil is to try and treat shift work sleep disorder. So the fact that, you know, if you do a string of nights, you're not necessarily well rested before going on because of the disturbance to your biorhythms. Whether there is,
I like the way they compare going on for. Oh, sorry, Frank. Carry on.
No, carry on.
I was going to say, I like the way they compare, you know, your average night shift on labour ward to being in the military and going to war.
it certainly
I
is
do
a
feel
mild
like war. That, but I'm not sure it's entirely accurate.
I think a very interesting study which needs to be done is something similar to this, using these methods of psychomotor tasks and cognitive assessment, but have a look at people on different days of a disrupted sleep pattern, because it's a very personal and unscientifically founded beef. But because I'm like all of you guys, I used to do 24-hour shifts. In fact, well, before the EWTD, we used to do 24-hour shifts, and then we switched to these runs of nights. I find that on night 3 or 4 of a set, when I've had to switch my sleep patterns, it's then at around 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning when I'm actually at my worst. Whereas having had a, you know, 24 hours, I can stay up for 24 hours and actually function quite well. It's the whole jet lag feeling which makes it worse. So I'd actually quite like to see something done similarly, but comparing 24 hours with somebody who's switched their sleep pattern.
Well, I'm doing 6 nights in a row this week, so I'll start taking modafinil halfway through and let you know how it goes.
So have we exhausted modafinil?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, cool. Brilliant. So, Mark, your news item is the only one that's actually been in the national press.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell us what Blood on Board is all about?
So, yeah, so as of last week, London Air Ambulance, or London HEMS, have become the first air ambulance in the UK to carry whole human blood with them on board, and therefore be able to transfuse blood to the trauma patients right there on the scene. And this is it's quite an achievement, because, as I'm sure you appreciate from in-hospital work, the regulations and paperwork surrounding blood transfusion is really, really rigorous these days. So it's taken several years of hard work and ongoing discussion with blood transfusion people and infection control people and so on. So they have at last achieved it, and we're looking forward to some extra lives saved that maybe otherwise wouldn't have been.
I first heard about this at a HEMS audit day. Like I say, when I first heard it, because it was announced with, you know, some good amount of fanfare, as we've seen in the national press, that, hey, now we're carrying blood on board. My first thought was, why haven't you been doing it beforehand? And that was just, I was like, well, that seems like an obvious thing to do. These people have been in trauma victims. They're going to be bleeding. I've certainly been down at Code Reds at the Royal London, and what these people need is blood and clotting factors and lots of it. But actually, you're right. It's the traceability and all the legal requirements that go with taking this has meant that it has been a mammoth task, hasn't it?
Right, and the safe storage and handling of the blood, so that, you know, nobody wants to be wasting blood. And I think at the moment they have several packs ready to go. So one for the aircraft and one for the car and one that stays in A&E and in various places. And it's only relatively recently that they've got suitable technology, or technology is maybe not the right word, but you know, suitable ways of storing and carrying this blood so that it doesn't get wasted, because on most days it won't be used. And so a system had to be developed to get that blood back into circulation, back into the hospital's stocks, so that it doesn't go to waste. It's a very precious
resource. How are they managing that? That they, you know, because there's such a, well, certainly in hospitals I've worked, you know, the blood comes out of the fridge, it's got to be used within half an hour, You know, well, you have half an hour to return it to the fridge, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so what they've got is what they're calling the Golden Hour box, which is a fairly small and simple box that's been used for some time by various militaries. And it's essentially a hollow box, the walls of which contain a liquid, so you freeze the whole box overnight, and then that'll stay at a fairly regular temperature for up to 48 hours. So with the Hems blood, they've got an arrangement, so they're getting pretty fresh blood that's very recently been donated, and they'll keep that in their box for 24 hours, at which point it'll all get put back into the hospital circulation and replaced with a fresh 4 units.
Nice pun on the word circulation, by the way.
Thank you. Unintended, but I'll take it. There are a few negatives that people are talking about. One is that as you can imagine, there is a bit of faff with paperwork, and we are supposed to collect a pre-transfusion group and save sample from the patient so that they can be appropriately typed once you get to hospital without the donated blood muddying the waters. And there is a fluid warmer unit which needs to be set up to give the fluid or the blood at an appropriate temperature. So there are people questioning about, you know, how many people need that blood so badly that they can't wait another 10-15 minutes until they get to hospital. But as Rick said, that every now and again there are these code reds, who are people who have bled or are bleeding to death, often from penetrating trauma, and these 4 units could quite feasibly buy that extra 10 or 15 minutes to getting to the point of definitive care.
Fantastic. So we'll put a link on the notes to the little video clip from the BBC website that Mark sent to us all. So that leaves us with, once again, I've forgotten, Mark's question of the month. So Mark, you set a fairly tricky one last month. Not a lot of answers.
I don't think quite close
to the zero mark. And I'm taking that our group of listeners all have no idea what the street value of cocaine is. I presume is the reason for that.
Well, it was a case of simple math as far as I was concerned. So Whitney Houston spent I can't count all these zeros, but I think it was $100 million on cocaine, which would be about £63 million. Working on a price of £40 per gram gives you just over 1.5 million grams. Using that at 40 milligrams per mil would give you 39,500 litres of Moffat solution, which would enable you to perform 3.9 septoplasties.
Per what?
What? 3.9 million septoplasties.
Oh, 3.9 million septoplasties. Okay.
If only she'd put her money to better use. So this month's question will be based on blood, as that's what I've been talking about so far. So London Hems will be carrying 4 units of O negative blood. So assuming average unit volume and 100% saturation of oxygen, how many millilitres of oxygen could those 4 units of blood carry?
And is blood 100% saturated in the bag?
No, it'll have to be pumped through someone's lungs for that to happen.
Blood must actually be saturated when it's sitting in a bag.
Yeah, I meant how much oxygen will it carry in a human.
Once it's been transfused.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's probably not very saturated in the bag, I don't know how.
Well, I don't know, because it's going to get bound to it, isn't it?
Next time I put up some blood, I might sneak a little sample through the blood gas machine. And report
Excellent.
Back.
Excellent.
Yeah, do that.
Yeah, excellent. Well, thank you very much for that, Mark. Hopefully we'll have a few more answers or correct answers to that. For the rest of you, our final test is in the form of this month's Biology or Bunkum. So we've been going with our cognitive enhanced themed episode, and these questions are all on things that either may or may not improve your memory. So number one, having an adenotonsillectomy can improve your memory. Number two, physical exertion reduces the accuracy of episodic memory. And number three, eating more dietary fiber improves your memory. So of those three, why don't we start with Frank for a change. Which one do you think is the bunkum?
I think number two is the bunkum.
Physical exertion.
Yeah.
Interesting. Just
because I'm in my randomized controlled study of one, I feel that my memory is a lot better when I've been exercising.
Okay, fair enough. Rebecca?
I'm going to go with three, just to be different, but based on nothing in particular.
You haven't noticed a relationship between the amount of fiber you in...
whole grain and memory.
No, yeah, exactly.
Not something you've
observed.
I'm strictly
a white toast girl.
That's what you've been doing wrong.
That and blonde is definitely not a winning
That's
formula.
A bad combination.
And Mark, which do you reckon is the bunkum there?
What was the question again? That was my hilarious memory-based joke. I will, of course, go for option number three.
Dietary fiber. Excellent. Okay, well... No one is surprised by the fact that having an adenotonsillectomy can improve your memory.
Well, you'd sleep better, wouldn't you? So then you'd be more alert during the day, so you'd have a better memory.
Ah, nailed it. Absolutely.
She's a genius.
I'm just thinking more about what I think you've made up.
It's not really the
scientific approach to your bunkum.
No, this was this actually. There's loads of references on this, but all of these I can actually reference from PubMed this month. But there was loads of stuff on this. Lots of kids who've got obstructive sleep apnea obviously have poor performance in school, and one of the cognitive aspects that is frequently studied is memory. And once they've had their adenotonsillectomy and are sleeping better, they do have a improved memory. So, fact.
Excellent.
Frank, I'm sorry to say, number two is, in fact, biology. It was a slightly tricky one, and it might have been a bit clearer if I'd said acute physical exertion reduces the accuracy of episodic memory. But this was a study, I can't remember which journal it is in, but again, I'll put the link up. It was quite an interesting study looking at policemen and running them through various scenarios after they'd gone and had to do some kind of quite rigorous assault course, and then getting them to remember certain facts about the scenario they'd just been involved with or just seen. And from my reading of the abstract, it all seemed to be kind of ongoing robbery or that type of things. And their episodic memory was much, much worse if they were a bit out of puff or they'd just done something. This actually has, the abstract went on to say this has implications for witness statements from people who have just gone through some kind of actual physical as well as emotional trauma, and how well they can remember the actual facts of what someone was wearing, what someone looked like, where people were standing. So I thought that was quite interesting, and I can see that being used in the future.
And you're hoping to use that in your defence one day.
Exactly, I'd store that one. It was a bit out of breath. It's just been running. Possibly remember what I look like. The dietary fibre is indeed the bunkum. Although the abstract I'll link to in a journal called Metabolism had kind of made this. Basically, it was a review article about the various great things that dietary fibre can do for you, and it was. Even the abstract sounded evangelical, you know. It improves your immune system, it can make you taller and everything else. But one of the things it kind of said as a one sentence of throwaway wild conjecture at the end was that dietary fiber might well improve your memory, and didn't seem to be based on anything else to do with the study. So I kind of labelled it as bunkum and decided I'd use that.
I chose it because I thought if it did improve my memory, I surely would have already learnt that from a cereal box by now.
Precisely. You would have seen Tony the Tiger. I think there can't be much fibre in Frosties, can there?
No, I think it's all
sugar. Yeah.
That may well be libelous.
Right. That's probably a good place to end it. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be back next month. But before then, Frank and I are off to Buenos Aires next week for the World Congress of Anesthesia. We'll be tweeting from the WCA as @gascast, so if you're there, tweet us up and say hello. And if we can tear ourselves away from the steak, red wine and tango dancing, we'll try and do some form of podcast special, so keep an eye on iTunes and the website. Until then, thanks for listening.